Coming up next, David Letterman talks to Tim DeChristopher.
Our next guest is an environmental activist who served almost 2 years in federal prison. 2 years in federal prison.
Gee.
Oh, for the love of God.
Tell you.
Like being here every night.
Well, have it on.
2 years in federal prison, resulting from an act of civil disobedience. He is the subject of a new documentary entitled Bidder, B-I-D-D-E-R, 70. Please welcome Tim DeChristopher, ladies and gentlemen. I want to make sure we get the important parts of this story. It's multifaceted, and all of it's important. Mm-hmm. Tell us, Bidder 70, there's an auction. You go to the auction. What's happening at the auction? What do you do?
It's a Bureau of Land Management auction for oil and gas rights. Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean?
It means that the Bureau of Land Management controls a lot of the public land in the West, and it's a multi-use agency. Mm-hmm. So that land is used for a lot of things, and one of the things it's used for is for energy development.
If they have reason to believe that there's gas and oil underneath the land, people holding mineral rights can then drill? Is that how it works?
Right, and so they're auctioning off the mineral rights.
I see. Yeah.
In these auctions.
And where is this land? Is it in Utah?
Yeah, this is all in Utah. Mm-hmm. And these are things that happen on a regular basis. This one was an unusual auction, unusual for its size, unusual for the proximity to national parks.
What national parks was it near?
Canyonlands and Arches.
And these are in Utah, and they're stunningly beautiful works of natural
art. Yeah, this is kind of the iconic landscape that people know.
How many acres are we talking about?
The parcels that I ended up winning were about 22,500 acres.
And in total, they were auctioning how many acres?
About 150,000.
150,000 acres.
Yep.
Now, how long had this land been up for auction? Was this a new development, or had this been in existence prior, or what was the circumstance?
Well, it was both, because the Bureau of Land Management has what they call resource management plans, which are these long-term development plans for how they're going to use the land. And these particular parcels had always been off-limits. And when the Bush administration came in, they started rewriting those long-term management plans. And that took them the entire 8 years to rewrite those.
At one point, under other administration, this land was considered sacred, maybe not the right word, but important to, for the culture of the community, the country, and
they,
the land.
They decided it was not appropriate for drilling.
Not appropriate for drilling, okay.
And so then they rewrote this, and then right before this auction happened, they announced all these new parcels, mm-hmm. which had always previously been off-limits,
right.
which were now being auctioned off.
So, and this coincides with the hunger for new, easy-to-find oil and gas. The prices are skyrocketing. We've got to get in and find more and more gas.
Yeah, it's kind of a prime example of the drill-now-think-later mentality that's really driving the climate crisis,
so now you go to the auction. And what were your plans to go to the auction? What were you going to do?
My plan was to do anything that I could to stand in the way of this. Mm-hmm. Over the course of that year and the years leading up to it, I'd been growing more and more concerned with climate change and seeing that what we were doing as a climate movement wasn't working, certainly wasn't working for getting our government to do anything about climate change. And so I'd been building up a commitment to do something greater. And at the same time, I'd been studying social movement history, seeing the need for civil disobedience and for confrontational strategies for social movements.
Did you have a specific strategy in mind when you went to the auction?
No. I had a commitment to do something to try to stand in the way of this auction, but thought that might be making a speech or standing up and yelling. It was right after that guy threw the shoe at Bush, so it was kind of in the back of my mind.
Did you have a spare shoe with you?
No, I was using both of them.
Both of your... Yeah. All right, so you go to the auction. It's held at a federal courtroom building, something like that?
It was held at the BLM offices, were actually upstairs from a shopping mall in Salt Lake City.
So now they open the land for auction, and a guy says to you, are you here to bid?
Yeah. I walked in expecting to cause some kind of disruption. They said, are you here to be a bidder? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, yes, I am.
Right.
Still thinking, okay, I'll sign up to be a bidder so that I can get inside and make a speech or throw a shoe at somebody.
Right.
Once I got inside, then I had that bid card in my hand, number 70, and realized that I could actually have a very big impact.
So that was it. You just walk in. They say, here's your thing. Enjoy the auction.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, I didn't quite know what to expect before I walked in, but it was kind of the TV auction with a guy in a cowboy hat talking fast.
And then you start bidding on parcels of land.
Yeah. It took me a little bit to make the decision, but first I started driving up the prices, and then I went all in.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of money are we talking about for one of these leases?
It started at $2 an acre. Mm-hmm. I won some parcels for $2 an acre.
Right.
Most of them were going for 10 to 12 before I started bidding. And that was part of what spurred me to action was seeing just how cheaply we're letting go of our public resources. And when I was just driving up the prices, I would drive it up to maybe $240 an acre sometimes.
And you often would be the winning bidder or just drive it up?
First, I was driving it up. Then I started winning. And I started winning every parcel and wasn't really trying to be subtle. I was there as an act of civil disobedience.
So all of a sudden, the kid, bidder 70, is buying hundreds of thousands of acres or 20,000 acres of federal land.
Yeah.
Right to drill.
Yeah.
Now, did they say, what did they say to you?
Well, they stopped the auction and took me out and they asked what my intentions were and
what tipped them off that this was something hinky going on here?
Like I said, I was there for an act of protest, so I wasn't trying to be subtle.
Right.
I was winning every single parcel. Mm-hmm. And all you got to do is like flick your bid card just a little bit here. And I started raising it higher and higher each time I'd win until I was holding it up way above my head. And then I just stopped bringing it down in between bids. I was just holding it up constantly.
So they say, Bob, we got a wise guy in row 8. Let's run him.
Yeah. So this law enforcement agent pulls me out and asks me what's going on. And I said, I'm trying to stop this auction in any way that I can because I think it's a threat to my future and a fraud against the American people. And he said, so you don't plan on paying for those parcels? and I said no. They interrogated me for a few hours and then released me. And that began a very long legal process that lasted about 2.5 years before I was finally convicted of 2 felonies and sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Now, here's how dumb I am. What you have described up to the 2.5 years in prison or whatever it was sounds like a prank. How do you end up doing 2 years in a federal prison for what sounds to me like a prank?
I think that's a complicated issue. I mean, part of it is certainly that, you know, the people who lost money because that auction was disrupted are the people that control our government and pull the strings on a lot of our federal agencies, including our Department of Justice. So they were certainly upset.
But why don't they just say, oh, you know, remember Bidder 70? Forget all that. We're starting over. Why couldn't they have just, they get rid of you. Okay, now here's the auction. We had a goofball screwing up our auction.
And that's the more interesting part, because I think people were ready for something like this in the climate movement. And that became the much more important part of what I'd done. Is that I had pushed the boundaries for the climate movement, and that really vaulted me into a new role for the movement, where I was out there speaking about civil disobedience. I was traveling around the country as an activist at that point. And people were listening, and the climate movement was in this transition phase where the appeasement strategies of big green groups had failed, and we were looking for something bolder and more confrontational.
So let me ask you, did your strategy to protect that land at auction, that worked? Because the BLM was ordered by the federal courts to take another look at that allocation?
Yeah, they revoked that auction, rescinded all those parcels. So it worked in that direct sense.
In that direction, you were successful in disrupting the auction.
Right. But going on, the impacts turned out to be much more important for what it meant for the climate movement.
Let's show a clip of the documentary, which is fascinating, and we're just scratching the surface here. I think we're going to see you in action at the auction. Take a look here, Tim DeChristopher.
Ordering a 4.5 and a 4.75 and a 5. Now listen, 5.5.
I saw right away that with that bid card that they'd given me, I could really disrupt this process. I had all these visions of my future and all the catastrophic effects of climate change. But if I start to bid on this, there's a decent chance I could go to prison. Could I live with that? And I thought, well, yeah, it would suck, but I could live with it. But knowing that I had a chance right in front of me to do something about it and didn't take it because I was afraid of the consequences. And I thought, no, I couldn't live with that.
So you go to prison for,
Yeah, I did 21 months.
Now,
just got released April 21st.
Knowing what we know about things, climate change and so forth, was it valuable, the sacrifice of 2 years in prison? Was it? Do you feel good about what you have done?
Are
we better off for your efforts, do you think?
I think I'm better off for my efforts.
In what sense?
I'm more at peace knowing that my actions in response to this crisis are actually appropriate to the scale of the crisis.
So it's at some point you can say to your family, to your friends, or to yourself, I tried. I tried to do a little something. I tried to help.
Yeah. And, you know, I expected the negative impacts of this. I expected to go to prison. Prison turned out to be not nearly as bad as I expected.
Now, that can't possibly be true.
Well, you know, we have a vastly different justice system today than we did a generation ago, with an order of magnitude more people in prison. And one of the things that a lot of people don't stop and think about is that one of the consequences of mass incarceration is that our prisons are filled with really normal people. You know, mass incarceration didn't happen because of some drastic shift in human nature. It happened because the private prison industry was able to change our laws that allow us to lock up a lot more normal people.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's how we get our audiences. when you felt the activism in you regarding climate change, you must have been hopeful and optimistic that change would work. We're at a point now where we know change is not coming, and it's now all about adaptability. We are not going to reverse the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So what's ahead of us?
Well, I mean, it is too late for any amount of emissions reductions to avoid catastrophic climate change. But I think it's important to stop and think about what it means to be too late. Because what it means is that we are committed to a period of very intense change, probably more intense than our civilization has ever seen. And to me, that makes activism more important than ever. Because if we're going to have to navigate through this period of intense change, it really matters who's steering the ship. And, you know, going through that period of rapid change with an educated and engaged citizenry that feels like they can hold their government accountable and determine the course of their own society, there's a lot of room for progress there. There's a lot of things that we need to fix in our society anyway. And there certainly be hardships, but there's a lot of opportunity there as well. But going down that road with an ignorant, apathetic citizenry that's afraid of their own government and feels like corporations get to write all the rules, that's where things can be pretty ugly and pretty scary.
And what you describe has to take place on a global basis.
Yeah.
The film is Bitter 70. I think you'll find this particularly interesting. This gentleman has done us all a favor. Tim DeChristopher, thank you very much. Great pleasure
thank
to
you.
Have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, Gandhi's grandson warns of World War III. Arunda Gandhi is interviewed by David Swanson. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Arun Gandhi, who lived with his grandfather Mahatma Gandhi from 1946 until his assassination in 1948. Arun Gandhi's books include Legacy of Love, My Education in the Path of Nonviolence, and the just-released children's book, Grandfather Gandhi, which I have also just ordered for my kids and look very much forward to reading. Arun Gandhi, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me on your show.
It is wonderful to hear your voice. I appreciated your speaking at an event I was part of years ago called Camp Democracy, and everything you've been doing for nonviolence since. And I have a lot of questions about what's happening in the world right now for you, but I wondered if you could tell us first about this children's book. I understand, without having yet read it, that it is about learning lessons about anger, and I wonder what place you think anger takes in either creating or in manufacturing consent for foreign policies today.
Well, certainly, you know, I experienced all these lessons from my grandfather as a little boy, and it made a great impact on me. And ever since then, I've been thinking of how to take the same message to children so that they can be influenced in the way I was influenced. But I didn't have the knowledge of writing for children, and so I kept putting it off. I wrote books for adults, but never got down to learning how to write for children until 9/11 happened in New York City. They invited me to come and speak and deliver a positive message a month after 9/11. And I gave my talk at the City Hall, and there were about 1,000 people there. And among them, there was this young lady who had just graduated and had learned how to write for children. And she heard the stories, and she felt motivated to come and speak to me a month later and offered to partner with me to write the book. And I said, good. goodness, that's what I've been waiting for. So the book came out, and the reason why I chose anger is because, you know, today we see that almost 80% of the violence that we experience in our lives, personally or collectively as a nation, is generated by anger. We get angry and we get so abusive and you know, abuse anger, and the result is, you know, either physical violence or passive violence. And both of them are equally bad. So we need to learn how to use that energy constructively and, you know, intelligently rather than abuse it.
But when the United States is dropping $2 million missiles on Syria and Iraq as if they cost nothing, surely that is motivated by profits for the weapons makers and electoral calculations. I mean, anger can't be the only factor at work there, can it?
No, it's not the only factor in that kind of situation. It is certainly a factor in a personal situation. But in the national situation, anger does play a role, because not all wars are declared just to use up the weapons. I mean, that is part of the reason behind it, but there has to be a little anger, and that anger motivates or justifies them in using this kind of violence.
Yeah, I think we've seen a definite difference. Tell me what you think between 1 year ago, when the public did not want to bomb Syria, and this year, when a significant percentage of the U.S. public wants to bomb Iraq and Syria. And I think the stories about beheadings and evil forces are a good bit of that. Do you think that's that public response is related to anger or fear, or what is driving
that
difference?
It's more response to fear. You know, we've been fed with a lot of fearful news about beheadings and about terrorism and about, you know, terrorists coming into the country and attacking us here, and all kinds of fear is fed into us, and so we are motivated by that fear to justify what we are doing in Syria. In the same way, the people, the terrorists there in Syria and in Iraq and other places in the whole of Middle East are motivated by anger and frustration. Anger towards people who have been exploiting them for so many centuries, anger from, you know, in the state of their nation and the oppression that they suffer there, and all of these things add up and cause anger, and they want to you know, express it against somebody, and that somebody happens to be us, because we claim to be the most powerful nation in the world.
It also has resulted in a lot of people thinking reluctantly that they have no choice but to support a bombing campaign, because the news asks, should there be a bombing campaign or nothing, and the polls don't, there are no polls telling us people prefer bombs to some nonviolent approach, because it's just bombs or nothing. And I wonder how you reply when people ask you, Gaddafi is supposedly, and of course this wasn't true, about to slaughter civilians in Benghazi. What do you do? The ISIS, and this was, you know, largely untrue, but ISIS is about to slaughter civilians on a mountaintop. What does a nonviolent advocate do? How do you respond to those sincere questions from people?
Well, you see, we have to first of all look at all of this as a culture of violence that has grown around us for centuries, and we have allowed it to happen because it's the easiest and quickest way to control things. We see this all the time. I mean, even at home, when we try to control our children, we are always using fear and punishment to control them. We tell them, you know, if you don't behave, you're going to be punished and you have to sit in a corner or whatever it is. So it's always fear that is used to control people. And when we do that at home with our children, that is the first seeds of violence that we plant in the minds of young people. So they grow up to believe that when somebody does something wrong, they need to be punished. And that mindset then, you know, results in what we see today. When somebody is doing something bad, we need to punish them. Now, when 9/11 happened, I wrote an article which nobody published because they said this is not the time to speak of peace and nonviolence. violence. But the gist of the article was that this is not the time for the U.S. to seek revenge. It is the time for us to do some introspection to find out why are those people in that part of the world so angry with us that they want to do such violence to us. And if we had stopped and done some introspection and tried to find out where we went wrong and remedy that, we wouldn't be embroiled in this kind of war that we can't put an end to. Now, I think that this is the beginning of the Third World War.
You do. Where do you expect this to go?
Oh, it's going to get, you know, every nation is going to be embroiled in there, and eventually it's going to spark off into a major Third World War.
With nuclear weapons?
Possibly. You know, when you have it, you'll use it.
And what can we best do to avert that course? Because...
Well, I think it's time for the people to get up and say enough is enough, and we don't want this kind of situation. We don't want violence anymore. We don't want wars anymore, and put more pressure on the government. But, you know, there again, the government of the world have played everything so well. They caught us trapped in a materialistic lifestyle where we are chasing our tails all the day, trying to buy and possess and protect the things that we possess, that we don't have time for these kinds of things.
We recently passed on October 2nd, which was the birthday of your grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi, and is the International Day of Nonviolence. And you wrote about these twin evils of militarism and materialism. Can you explain the connection?
Well, you know, we have a materialistic lifestyle. So when you have a lot of possession, you want to protect them because you're afraid that somebody is going to steal them from you. So you have a military along with it. And so one feeds again on the other, and both grow as twin. One of the worst things that happened after World War II was up to World War II, whenever a nation went to war and needed armament, they converted the consumer industries to produce armament for that period of time. And then when the war ended, those industries reverted back to producing the consumer good. After World War II, when we got embroiled in the Cold War, we decided we must have a whole industry of armament. And so we invested money in building industries that would produce nothing but weapons of mass destruction. And President Eisenhower warned us again. He said, beware of this military-industrial complex that is going to ruin us one day. And we are seeing that happening now. We are so totally controlled by this military-industrial complex and the fear factor that, you know, we have to just, you know, think. They tell us that there's no other option but this, and so we believe in it, and we support the Syrian war.
Do you think that people are accepting war as not just part of the economy permanently, but as an active part of foreign policy permanently? Because they now seem to have started a war in a congressional election year, the opposite of all the other ones, with Congress saying nothing, as if it weren't a change. They haven't given it a name.
Drums of war.
Roll out the drums of war.
Roll out the drums of war.
Roll out the drums.
prophets for? Who are they who bear the cause when a country takes the logo war? Who gives the orders, orders the torture? Who gets to no-bid contracts the future? Who lies, then bombs, then calls it an error? Who makes a fortune from fighting terror? Who is the enemy trying to crush us? Who is the enemy of truth and justice? Who is the enemy of peace and freedom? Where are the courts now when we need them? Why is impeachment not on the table? We better stop them while we are able. Roll out the drums of war.
Roll out the drums of war.
Roll out the drums of war.
Roll out the drums of war. If you know,
roll out the drums of war. Whatever you believe, the necessary course to be depends on who you trust to identify the enemy who took this country to war. Long before the peace was lost, who are the prophets for? Who are they who bear the cause? Who laid down their lives? Who will live with the sacrifice of our best and brightest hopes, the flower of our youth, freedom and the truth?
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.